When I was first introduced to Vipassana, it was in Thailand, and I went to a small meditation monastery and basically said, I'm here and tell me what to do. And the abbot of the monastery then gave me some very simple instructions that were meant to be the entire instructions. I don't remember everything that I was told, but I had the impression that now I was supposed to notice and note everything. And everything was included as part of the practice. Nothing was excluded. And this is one of the basic ideas of insight meditation, is inclusive awareness. But I interpret it as I had to kind of pay attention to everything. And since many things were happening at once, I was smart enough to know that, well, I can't really pay attention to everything, all the millions of things that are happening, all the sounds and scents and sight objects and thoughts and feelings. And you know. So I thought, well, I can't do it all, so I'll just do sounds. And so I just tried to race after every sound that was happening in the monastery. It was kind of a busy monastery. And to catch every single one that was happening in the moment. And so I ended up with a headache. So I went back to the abbot and said, you know, I just explained what had happened. And he said, no. You're not supposed to pay attention to everything all at once. You're supposed to pay attention to everything, but only one thing at a time. And you take your time with each thing. You don't rush to try to be aware of as many things as you possibly can. Take your time, and whatever is the predominant thing that arises, then you take your time and you really connect with that. He didn't use the word intimate, but you're intimate with it. You're there for that experience. There's no hurry. You're not trying to get beyond it or get over it or get on to the next thing. Just there for that experience. So that was made a world of difference, of course, rather than the way I was practicing was rushing. You know, NPMs, the more notes per minute, the better yogi you are. So try to just note and be aware of as much as possible. That was the kind of, I guess, was the principle I was operating under. But when the teacher explained to me, no, it's the quality of your attention to each thing. And over time, you might pay attention to everything, but there's no rush here. And so that made a big difference for me, being attentive to each thing. I tell this story as a lead up to the topic of today, which is joy. In this teaching of liberty dependent arising, joy arises in dependence on gladness. And gladness rises in dependence on faith, and faith on suffering. So, there are, in fact, many, many, many things happening in direct experience any given moment. Just where I'm sitting here, there's lots of sounds that are around, and city sounds. I hear the trains, I hear the traffic, I hear sounds in the building, my voice. There's so many things to notice that I could see. I could look at the screen, and I should, in fact, the main thing I see in my screen is myself. So I don't know if that's very useful. So I'm going to change that now that I notice what I'm looking at. And now I see, 25 tiles, 25 faces. It's very nice. And so there's 25 of you I could look at. That's a lot of people to choose between. Do one at a time. It could take a while to really do it. And then there's other things, lights in this building and the carpet and the table here with paper on it. And, you know, so many things happening in the present moment. There's a brown shopping bag over there on a chair. So it goes on, all the things to notice in the present moment. And that's just, you know, sights and sounds, and what about smells and touch and body sensations? And then there's the emotions and feelings and mental states and thoughts, and so much is actually happening in the present moment, just in my little area here. So how do I choose what to pay attention to? Well, we have some choice. And most people will have a choice, will already choose for themselves, because we have preferences. We have things that we're, and so we look for our preferences. We have desires, and we look for, tune into what we want. I remember I was surprised when I was looking for a futon. I had no idea there were so many futon stores. When I looked for a mattress some years later, I didn't realize there were so many mattress stores. I'd driven by them many times, but you know, they weren't anything that I wanted, so I didn't really notice that as I drove around. So desires can affect what we look at. Or we can be afraid, and the fears predispose us to look for dangers. We can have aversions, and we notice what's wrong. We can look through the filter of me, myself, and mine, where we're the main character in our novel, and everything is about us. And so we look around, and everything is seen through that lens, and things that don't relate to the self are ignored, but things which are somehow relate to our sense of self are paid attention to. So this is trying to say is that for people who don't choose where their attention goes consciously, to some degree, the mind chooses for you. But what we pay attention to makes a big difference. So, for example, it's been said that one of the leading causes of depression, not the only cause, but one of the leading causes of depression, is rumination, which means you take some idea and cows ruminate, where they gurge it up to the grass from their stomach up to their mouth, and then they chew and chew and chew and chew, and then it goes back into their stomach and ruminates some more. It's just the whole process of doing it over and over again. So to ruminate our thoughts, like we're cows, I guess. That's, I don't know. But if the thoughts we're ruminating by are deflating thoughts, like self-critical thoughts, or somehow thoughts of hopelessness, or it can really drain the energy, even the life force from a person. It's very discouraging, over and over and over again, the self-talk. And so somehow the mind is focusing on those thoughts. Those are important. And it makes a big impact to keep receiving that conditioning. That's the conditions of certain kinds of thoughts has an impact on us. It has an influence on us and can cause depression. If someone comes along and suddenly decides, you know, a group of your friends come along and suddenly decide that it's not your birthday, but they're going to celebrate it anyway, and they have your favorite cake and food and whatever, and they're just completely happy with you and love you and smile, and, you know, a good number of people might, you know, perk up, and for those, you know, that gets attention, and all the goodness that's coming has a very different influence than all the, you know, all the negative self-talk. So what we pay attention to makes a difference. So the Buddha seems to have said, and to kind of paraphrase him, that it's useful to notice suffering. It's useful to pay attention to suffering. It's useful to admit there is suffering. It's useful to be realistic about the suffering we have. And some people hear Buddhist teachings like on the Four Noble Truths, and they're just so happy hearing it. Finally, someone's saying something real. Finally, someone's saying, yes, there's suffering in this world. Finally, they're talking about it. They're not pretending it's not there. They're not trying to make a rosy picture of things. But they're just really stopping and looking and naming and encouraging us to really recognize and study and recognize the suffering. So in all the kind of 84,000 things that are happening in the present moment, there is a kind of a Buddhist selection process that says that it's useful to notice that you're suffering. And some people find that tremendously inspiring because it's real. And some people find it tremendously depressing. They already know they're suffering, and they're already suffering pretty badly. But Buddhism also emphasizes that you should also pay attention to happiness. That happiness is also an important object of attention when it's happening. And it's as equally important to attend to happiness as it is to attend to suffering. And so now we have two things to pay attention to. We can pay attention to our suffering, and we can pay attention to our happiness. You don't need to spend a lot of time focusing on your little toe. So in terms of all the possible things you could pay attention to in the present, the Buddhism kind of simplifies it for you. And your little toe is not one of the ones that you usually need to give much attention to. So, but suffering and happiness, especially if you're interested in not suffering, there's something very... But then if we pay attention to suffering, how do we pay attention to it in such a way that we don't suffer more? How do we pay attention to suffering so that isn't a kind of rumination or isn't a kind of a negative influence, just a drag and drains us? How do we focus on happiness so we don't get attached to it and disappointed and betrayed when it goes away? What's a realistic way or a beneficial way to be with suffering? What's a beneficial way of being with happiness? And that just asking that question, I think, is a powerful question if you assume there's a good answer, which there is. And that's one of the tasks that each of us has to discover, partly for ourselves, is how can I be realistic? How can I be honest, realistic, and usefully present for how much I suffer so that it leads to happiness, so that it's onward leading on a path to liberation? And how do I bring attention to happiness so it does the same thing? So this is, you know, this is part of the art of all this, is to consider these things for yourself. And so so you have this capacity for attention. And how do you use it? How do you develop it so that it leads to something really good? And there's many answers to that question. I would be a mistake to suggest there's one way. Mistake to say you're only supposed to pay attention to suffering and only pay attention to to happiness. But we do have some choice in this matter. And luckily, we don't necessarily have to choose between them, because there's a third thing happening. There is, sometimes there's suffering, sometimes there's happiness, but there's also how we attend, how we bring our attention to anything at all. And where the happiness can live is in how we attend, how we engage, how we're intimate with our experience. So that if the experience we're attending to is suffering, rather than getting locked into the suffering or caught in its web, in its orbit, mindfulness is to be not caught in the orbit or in the gravitational pull of suffering, but to kind of, in a sense, step out of its orbit, out of its gravitational pull, and know it in a way where the knowing feels good. To know it in such a way that, the suffering is a little bit of a drag, but the knowing, being aware of it, is kind of calm, it's relaxed, it's open, it's not clinging, it's not resisting, it's not agitated. It's just very simple. Oh, look at that, I'm suffering. What a dramatic difference this is for me compared to maybe how it used to be, where I thought I had to fix the suffering, get rid of the suffering, change it, understand it, analyze it, do something with it. There's a whole paradigm shift that happens when I realize that I can be happy even with my suffering, depending on how I pay attention to it, depending on what I'm doing as I engage it. And so if you engage it as part of a path to freedom, then you're not pulled into its orbit. Then you're not lost in the suffering. Then you're already beginning to become free. If you're knowing the suffering with a kind of clarity, this is suffering, in the very clarity of that, there's a kind of freedom, maybe even a kind of delight, the happiness there. So there we begin. We have faith, we have suffering, we have faith that there's a way out. And we discover that, we can discover that through the practice we do, and one of the ways is how we're aware, how we engage in it. And so part of mindfulness is not just understanding what's happening, but also being able to understand how we engage with what's happening. The quality of the attention. And for me, in that first retreat, the quality of the primary quality of my attention those first days was I was in a hurry to get to know, to be aware of as many things as possible. And then the teacher told me, no, slow down, just one thing at a time. And then I discovered that, yeah, I could just kind of take my time and connect fully with something and then connect to something else. And that was so much more enjoyable. It was enjoyable to take my time and not be in a hurry and really kind of feel and sense each thing, each inhale, just really there for that. Each exhale, whatever it was. And there's having faith and having a practice we can do, and sometimes it's so good, feel so glad that we can start practicing. There are times I had kind of sometimes a dark night of the soul kind of time in my practice that had a lot to do, or was very much how much connected to not being able to go and retreat. I had a tremendous, you know, there was this tremendous drive. I wouldn't call it an attachment, but I called it a biological imperative to continue my practice where I had left it off. And nothing else really was important anymore, except somehow continuing that. And when I couldn't get back to retreat, it was kind of a little bit difficult time for me. There was kind of a bit of grief, a bit of longing, variety of things. And then I got to go. And I got to start. And I was so glad. I hadn't really, you know, it didn't really matter how distracted I was or how rusty I was about practicing. I was just so glad to be back. And then I started doing the practice. And then how we do the practice is so important. And I certainly learned through trial and error, through lots of suffering, that I tried practicing in ways that weren't so useful. I strained. I tried to avoid things, avoid my suffering, avoid my feelings, and so I can get concentrated. I tried to, you know, bear down to get concentrated. I played pinball with my thoughts, trying to just kind of flip, you know, push them away, just kick them away, you know, like a pinball flipper. And it was kind of an interesting imagination to do that, but that just made me more agitated. So I can go on. I have a long list of ways I practiced that didn't work. and that's, I think, probably true for most of us. We discover that, that worked yesterday, but it doesn't work today. So how do I bring attention to this now? And how do I apply myself now? And this is where the teachings on conditionality, I think, are quite important. So to repeat, you know, the teachings on dependent arising conditionality is that for some things to arise, some things to occur, they arise when the conditions come together for it. And when the conditions come together, then that allows something to happen, or they provide the conditions to influence what's happening in a certain way. And part of practice is to allow healthy, beneficial conditions to condition us. Sometimes when I was in my early practice, I thought I was responsible for everything. And one of the symptoms of that, one of the results of that I'm responsible for everything kind of thing, was feeling guilty all the time because things weren't so good. And so certainly I was responsible for how things weren't good. Another downside of excessive responsibility was feeling that, for sure, that other people, I was responsible for other people's suffering. I had to take care of them. So I learned, you know, that there's all kinds of, and then to be too responsible for your own practice, like it's up to me to get concentrated, it's up to me to stay mindful, it's up to me to make progress or whatever that might be. I have to kind of huff and puff and try harder. But one of the ways that Dharma practice unfolds is actually without our agency, without us being the ones who does the practice. But we have our responsibility, and our primary responsibility is to put the conditions in place or to recognize those conditions that support the growth of the practice of the Dharma in us. So if we're ruminating about how terrible the world is and everybody's bad or something, that's going to influence how we feel. But if we practice generosity and think about our generosity, that's going to maybe influence us in a very different way. But in order to be influenced by the good, it isn't that we make ourselves feel good because of the good, but rather we allow something to happen. We allow ourselves to take in. We allow it to be registered in our system. And this is one of the big points I want to make in this talk, is the idea that part of practice is getting out of the way to allow something to happen and allow something to unfold and allow something to let it have its influence on us. And then things begin to change in practice, but we don't feel like we're the agent of them. We're not causing the change. We're just contributing the conditions. And I kind of like the silly rewording of or translating of a English phrase. We put in the conditions, and then Dharma willing, the Dharma unfolds within us. The Dharma willing. So this idea, I like it because this idea that there's something that's not me that's operating here, and to allow that to be there. But if we only do the allowing, that's naive and magical thinking. But what we contribute is the conditions. And then we also contribute being open to receive the good influences that comes from it. So maybe an example would be, if it's a cold day and I'm kind of shivering from the cold, but if you stand in the sun, the sun's actually shining brightly, strongly, and you can get warm if you stand in the sun. But I'm walking in the forest, and there's places where this sun comes down. But I just keep rushing around between trees and under the canopy, kind of dipping in for a moment in the sun here, and then going into the shadows and into the sun and shadows and looking for the best place or trying to find a good, do something, I don't know, just being agitated or, you know, hoping I'll get warm. But all I really need to do is need to stop someplace where the sun, some clearing where the sun is shining, and then stand in such a way, maybe, you know, stand completely in the front of my body facing the sun, so I have the most surface area that can slowly warm up, receiving the rays from the sun. I don't make myself warm, but I put myself in a situation where the sun can warm me up. So I have to allow the sun a chance to do its work. So it's a little bit like that in this Dharma practice and meditation, is that we offer something to the practice, but in a certain way, at the same time, we're allowing something to influence us. We're allowing a condition to have do its work on us. We're allowing the sun of the Dharma to warm us up. But for that, you have to stand still, sit still enough, be still enough, or open enough, not run around too much, not run around in your thoughts. In a sense, the less you can think, the quieter you can think, the more space there is between your thoughts, the more room there is for the whole field of attention to receive the good influences of things which are beneficial. And so, in my early years, I thought I was so responsible that I was always straining and trying and doing, with no idea that I had to get out of the way and allow for something to unfold as well. And it was a hard thing to trust. What do you mean allow something? There's nothing in there that's going to do anything, any good. This is magical thinking. This is, you know, this is maybe some kind of sentimental idea of, I don't know what. But this combination, we offer something, and then we're open to receive. And I really like that language. We offer something in our practice. It's a gift. And then we're open to receive a gift back. This mutuality. And so when we are bringing our attention to the breathing, I like the expression giving our attention to the breath. It's a gift. Attention is a powerful, wonderful thing. We just like you can receive a gift of someone else who really pays attention to you, and it feels so good that someone's listening. So we can do the same for ourselves. We give ourselves the gift of attention, something as simple as the breathing, and then we receive the gift of breathing has to give us. So we come to happiness. It's part of the gift that comes with practice. One of the turning points in the life of the Buddha that was kind of key to him understanding the path to liberation was when he appreciated the joy, the well-being that can come from meditation practice, specifically for jhana practice, in the way it's traditionally told. But he discovered that it's by feeling joy that's the direction forward. For the further, that sets the conditions, sets the conditions in place that allows for other things to follow. And he said, this kind of Dharma joy, you don't have to be afraid of. And this apparently was a very big thing in ancient India, because many of the ascetics of his time had a very negative opinion about any positive emotion. Joy and happiness, they worried that it was too easy to get attached, and it was kind of a dirty thing to experience, because it was kind of like sensual pleasure or sexual pleasure, which was kind of a no-no, a taboo among the ascetic practitioners of his time. And so it was kind of radical, apparently, for him to discover that there's this other kind of joy and happiness that I think he would say is non-sensual in a certain way, that you didn't have to be afraid of. Not only that, it opens up to the path of freedom. And the Buddhists, in the ancient time of the Buddha, they were known as being the happy ones. The Buddha was sometimes called the happy one too, but the happy ones. And people in the suttas are stories of people seeing the Buddhist monks and nuns and saying, they're always smiling. Apparently that was remarkable enough that they got recorded. So yes, we stop for suffering, but we make room for happiness. And what I'd like to propose is that there is more opportunities for well-being than you usually avail yourself of. There's more pleasure, there's more joy, there's more happiness, there's more delight, there's more things to be glad about than most of us bother with. Because we have important suffering to think about. We have important things to do and accomplish and get on with. You know, I don't have time for this happiness thing and joy thing because I have my to-do list. But, you know, there's a beautiful sunny day outside. You can just go out and take in the sun and the beautiful colors of the trees. And No. I mean, I have things to do. I have things to worry about or plan. So on retreat like this, it's meant to be a time when most of the to-do list is put aside. You stick it in a drawer, and so you have this great permission, opportunity to avail yourself without trying too hard and forcing the issue, but in a simple, ordinary way, paying attention to one thing at a time and really letting it register, that thing, but to choose to let those things be things that have a beneficial influence on you, that somehow feed you or nourish you in the inside. You can overdo it, and if all you're ever trying to do is to do all good things and feel good all the time, you probably won't succeed. It's probably just a dead end. But to some degree, part of the practice is also to allow what is wholesome to influence us, to have a nourishment for us, to support us. And perhaps there are ways that you could enjoy yourself more without getting, you know, without getting agitated, without getting busy trying to enjoy, without chasing after pinnacle of joys. And, you know, well, guilt said I'm supposed to allow to just enjoy and allow it for happiness. And I might as well go to Disneyland. I mean, that's the place, you know. And yeah, you might enjoy it, but I don't think you're going to have a settled mind. I don't think it's going to help you have this deeper, it might be kind of more surfacey, but the deeper wellsprings of something real deep, wellsprings of well-being probably don't come out of doing the roller coaster at Disneyland. But to some degree, in the simplicity of a retreat life, where there's, are there ways to begin enjoying yourself more? To feel the well-being, to feel the good fortune, to be glad about what's here. Not to deny the suffering, not to deny the tragedies, not to deny the difficulties we have. Remember, Buddhists pay attention to that too. but in addition. And one of the reasons to do this is that when there's feelings of well-being and we really feel some joy and happiness, it becomes easier to realistically and honestly and truthfully or something attend to how we suffer. The untrained mind, the mind that hasn't practiced, it's too easy that as we pay attention to the difficulties we have, old habits come into play, old conditioning, old aversions and clingings and attachments come into play, and it just makes it worse. But there's something about Dharma joy, Dharma well-being, that lets us settle down and open. Oh, it's like this. It's okay now to feel it. It relates to what I said at the beginning, that how we pay attention is so important. And so how we open to suffering is so much easier when we feel contented, settled, happy, present. So to begin, kind of, where does the happiness come from? Is there simple, ordinary ways, realistic ways, ways that are not spiritual bypasses, that are, you know, not a big deal, but just maybe you can spend a little bit more time appreciating in the 84,000 things happening in the present moment? Why do you keep focusing on focusing on the fact that your socks have a hole in them? And you hope the other people in the retreat don't notice. I mean, is that what one you spend your spend? Is that the best influence you could have on yourself as you're meditating and practicing? It's one of the advantages of these Zoom retreats is people can't see your socks usually. So, our minds are so. I mean, I don't know, but I can't speak for all of you, but I suspect one or two of you are a little bit like me, and these minds are kind of crazy, what they think about and what they do and where they go and what they pick up. And, you know, it's like, it's been said that these minds have no shame. It's kind of like an amazing thing. It's good to stand in awe. Wow, this mind is out of control, or what? This is amazing. But you might have more choice than you realize. Maybe you can realize that this hole in the sock thing is not worth a lot of attention. What's maybe better is happy you have socks if it's cold. Wow, I have socks. People in the world who don't have socks. So, on retreat and with Dharma practice, one source of happiness is Dharma happiness or Dharma joy that comes directly from doing the practice. And it's probably different from different people how this works. But one way it works is that at some point, it can just feel so good to be practicing, that you have something to do that's so wholesome and so good. This is like one of the most wholesome things you can do is to practice. Feel the fortune of it and then to actually do it and engage. And after a while, it kind of kicks in and it no longer feels like it practices climbing uphill, but it's more like rolling downhill. Or I remember many years ago when I was running in the mountains, I started running. I hadn't been running ever, really, and I started running. And I found it extremely difficult to run the first 100, 300 yards. It's like it seemed like every cell in my body was saying, stop. And my thoughts were like, I can't do this. I shouldn't be doing this. I'll probably get a heart attack. But then I would keep going, and after 100 or 300 yards of some length, something would begin to kick in, the harmony of the breathing with the body, or I don't know what was going on physiologically. And it became, okay, now it's easier. And after I ran for a while, after even running uphill, there was kind of like, there was a lot of energy involved, but it kind of felt effortless. It felt like I was being carried by the running rather than I was to strain so much. So with Dharma practice, mindfulness as well, meditation, at some point we give ourselves over to it. And here we have the word giving again. But we get into the flow of it. We keep doing it, doing it, doing it. And I love the little kid's book, The Little Train That Could. That, you know, trying so hard to get up the hill, it can do it, it can do it. And that's how it feels like sometimes. We're the, like the little meditator that can. You know, like, yes, you can do it. Little meditator that can. You keep doing it and doing it and doing it. And at some point, it kicks in. Sometimes something happens where just the doing of it is so nice. It's so wonderful. So for some people, that's where the joy comes from. From some people, sometimes the joy just comes as a pure gift out of the blue. Sometimes the joy comes because we're getting concentrated. And there's something about the peace of concentration, the integration, the healthiness of concentration, where the mind is no longer agitated, jumping around, the mind is not in conflict with anything, the mind is not fragmented, it's kind of unified and settled. It's such a pleasure to have a mind like this, such a pleasure to have a mind and body that's come together and unified. And, you know, it just feels so joyful. Some people say it's because somehow that state of mind of being concentrated is a little bit like a serotonin producer. And so the serotonin goes through your body and you feel like all this joy. That could well be, but I don't know, it seems a little reductionistic. It seems like then we might as well just take a pill, serotonin pill, if that's all it is. But with Dharma practice, we're not just taking a pill. We're actually getting all the benefits of working all our kinks out, seeing our kinks, seeing our little foibles, seeing all the places of attachment and preoccupation and be slowly practicing little meditator that could, practicing, working out the kinks, ironing out the folds, until this harmony comes into place. And then we're settled in this harmony, and for some people that's where the joy comes up. But as I said, we don't really know where the Dharma joy comes from. But it certainly helps if there's gladness. It helps if we have faith in this practice and what we're endeavoring to do. And it helps if the faith is in something worthwhile. And one of the most worthwhile things to have faith in is there is a way to bring suffering to an end. There is a way to lessen our suffering. And in the Buddhist world, this is one of the most noble things a person can do. One of the most meaningful and purposeful things we can do, not just for ourselves, but for others as well. And so to feel that and feel the faith, yes, this is what I'll say, this is what I say yes to. And even if I have to be not just a little train that could, I'm just the teeny meditator that can. I don't care. This is worthwhile. I'm going to give my life to this. And then to feel the gladness of that. And from the engagement and the doing it, have this Dharma joy begin to arise. And all along, learning the art of allowing, not just being the doer, but practicing and making space so something that's not you can have an influence. Something that you not you has room to grow and develop. But you have to put the right conditions in place so the right thing grows. If you spend your time bitter and angry at the unfairness of life, that's a condition for one kind of thing to grow and develop, something that probably is not good for you. But if you allow the wholesome to come in, that will benefit you in other ways, in beneficial ways, something that's good for you. So since the topic today is joy, and yesterday is gladness, one of the things that you might do as you pay attention to one thing at a time, slowly, as if you have all the time in the world to take in this thing. If it is, notice more the things which are wholesome. Notice more the things that bring you not only joy, but a joy that helps you become more peaceful, more settled, a joy that encourages you to want to be in the present moment, a delight or joy, or that, oh, this is a good place to be here. The classic instructions are sometimes are do things like, in the place you're going to meditate, make sure it's clean. That it's a very different condition than if it's chaotic and messy and dirty. For some people, that just is a little bit of good conditioning, something nice that comes here and has a good impact on us. Maybe spend a little bit of time appreciating yourself. It turns out that if you're really as bad as you think you are, there's probably still 2 or 3% in there that's pretty good. If you spent some good time appreciating those 2 and 3%, that's really good. That's a wholesome influence. It'll probably up you to 4 to 6% very quickly. It'll grow and develop. So you probably have 2 or 3% in there. If I said, you know, pay attention to what's wholesome and good in you, you'd say, well, you know, I don't have anything. But come on, 2 or 3% of you, please. So what can you open to? What can you allow for that's already here? This is not Pollyannish. This is not pretending. This is not artificial, making something up. What is happening here in the 84,000 things of the present moment that feels like it supports the Dharma movement to wholesomeness, to happiness, to well-being, to peace, to contentment, to tranquility, to honesty, to an ability to be really present for how difficult your life is to your suffering. But present for it in a way that you're not caught in the orbit of your suffering. So don't make it a big project, don't get busy, please, but maybe you can avail yourself of more moments of well-being that are already here, already available, than you usually avail yourself of. And maybe it'll support your subtleness in the present moment, your ability to stay here and not be easily distracted or preoccupied. And maybe it'll teach your mind that it's okay to be trusting enough, to be satisfied enough with this moment, this circumstance, to be present for it, to really be present, to really be here for this, for this, for this. The best nourishment for the heart comes from what we're connecting to in the present moment. So, joy. Suffering is conditioned for faith that there's a way out of suffering. Faith is a condition for gladness. Gladness is a condition for joy. And then tomorrow, Inez will talk about tranquility. And that this Dharma joy is a condition for tranquility. And I mention that today because that's one of the purposes of this Dharma joy, is not to get excited, but rather to feel more at peace, less in conflict with things, just here for our experience. So thank you very much. And so tonight there's an occasional opportunity for some joy, if you'd like. And that is, the people who are full participants of the retreat can do a drop-in practice discussion with Inez. And I think Inez, she brings me a lot of delight or joy. So maybe, you know, you'll get a little taste of transmission of her delight in the practice. But that's at 7:15, for those of you who'd like to go. And so do I dare end this talk with the encouragement to please enjoy yourself. Thank you.